So, my address today is entitled Cultural Christianity, and it was inspired by that most famous atheist, Richard Dawkins, describing himself as a cultural Christian, as opposed to a believing Christian, an LBC. And I was rather amused and amazed at one of the most famous atheists in the world describing his fears of losing our beautiful buildings. And he also mentioned the rise of Islam. So there's in that interview, there's a contrast between Christianity and Islam. Even though he says he doesn't believe in Christianity, he prefers cultural Christianity to the rise of Islam. And it made me wonder what cultural Christianity is and what it might mean to a famous atheist. Richard Dawkins did mention the coming of Islam to Europe, which is a fear that has often been weaponized on our continent, and is a shorthand for the arrival of the other in the form of persons of a different color. In a scene that was somewhat frightening and quite unbelievable, especially to the older members of the congregation who remember the Troubles, we saw loyalists right alongside the Ku Klux No protesters in Belfast who were waving tricolors. So we had two sects of the same religion who had often been at loggerheads, who represent like the two religions and the two nations that exist on our island. It was strange for me to see them come together against foreigners. However, I'm not going to discuss controversial events today, but rather explore this concept of cultural Christianity from my own experience having grown up in South Africa. So this conflation of history, culture, and religion is a key concept to our development of our conception of ourselves living in the state in the 21st century, even if religious observance among cultural Christians is at an all-time ebb. And when I say cultural Christians, I'm going to acknowledge the elephant in the room and say that cultural Christianity is often a way of saying white people. And trust me, I grew up with this in South Africa. I think it might be what Richard Dawkins may have meant, but he does, especially when he refers to it as talking about Islam. So, rationality, science, and the holy trinity of education, welfare state, and economic growth have gnawed away at much of the need for a religious safety net. A religious community, as we all know, often provided education, healthcare, charity, which people often needed in times past, and which we don't have as much need for it. Well, we have the need for it, but it's generally run by the state. And this concept of progress has much to commend it and has seen us move from a profoundly religious and feudal society to an industrial one which provides most of our needs and allows us to travel, transport goods, and communicate across vast distances. Benedict Anderson described how religion played a role in imagined communities, describing how the 18th century marks not only the dawn of the age of nationalism, but the dusk of religious modes of thought. We can understand how religious identity has progressed from a single concept of Christendom to the confessional allegiances that would eventually underpin the development of our own concept of nation states, even on our own island. While medieval communities may seem to have existed in simultaneity, which fused past and future into an instantaneous present, the concept of the progression of time is a relatively modern one. Thus, we mark the dates of the publication of the 95 Theses, the break with Rome, and the outbreaks of war and signing of peace treaties, as well as scientific and geographic discoveries, as progress. Time is portrayed as marching in linear progression, perhaps like Christian soldiers who march ever onward. That this concept of linear time and progress coincided with exploration, colonization, and exploitation is perhaps no accident, as it created international competition between kingdoms for colonies and resources in the global south, which further enhanced not only their national identity and the emergence of wealthy elites, but also the rise of a colonized other. These people were not only non-Christian, but as such were ripe for religious conversion and quite often economic exploitation as well. This era marks the beginning of the first colony in Cape Town, intended as a victualling station for ships traveling to the Dutch East Indies, now the nations of Malaysia and Indonesia. These Muslim countries later found their sense of nationality in the 20th century as they and many other colonies sought independence from European and Christian colonizers. While many such newly minted nations were also grounded in a religion which othered them from their colonizers, perhaps the South African perspective offers a commingling of Christianity and race that gives the lie to the concept of Christianity as a nation of a single race or even a single confession. The Reformation and the Enlightenment meant that the single concept of Christendom had begun to unravel by the time the Dutch laid out their company gardens under the shadow of Table Mountain. A sundial in the middle of the garden gives a sense of the passage of time, marking an end to the homogeneous empty time which Walter Benjamin describes in Illuminations. The Khoisan hunter-gatherers who had lived in southern Africa since time immemorial, adorning cliff faces and caves with beautiful art, celebrating a union with nature reminiscent of the Garden of Eden. This prehistoric time existed outside the calendar by which we date history before and after Christ, a kind of any-when. I have considered this concept of cultural Christianity from a South African perspective, meaning a shorthand for the white colonizers. The white settlers often considered themselves intellectually and morally superior to those they encountered in these newly discovered lands. They cited literacy, technology, and the ethics of Christianity as key concepts behind this rationalization. Yet the ethics of Christianity soon became shorthand for a concept of us and them, which could be used to justify enslavement and exploitation in the name of progress and even salvation. Of course, this is not a Christian concept as we would understand it today, and slavery dates back to classical antiquity and beyond into even more primitive societies. When we think of Christian liberation, we consider the Admiral campaign by William Wilberforce as a great victory for Christian ethics, but forget that Britain was both a colonizing power and home to the Royal African Company, which enslaved countless people. Should one read Thomas Pakenham's The Scramble for Africa, we can read about the campaigns of David Livingstone, who was a tireless advocate for European intervention in Africa to end the scourge of slavery. Our sense of Christian compassion in Ireland has led to many charitable endeavors to help Africans and sent missionaries to Africa as well. I lived for many years in Cape Town on Derry Road, where there was a Catholic church at the one end and a Dutch Reformed one at the other, and near a retirement home for Irish nuns who were teachers in schools for mixed race students in the Cape Flats. When I say mixed race, I mean the offspring of mixed marriages in this polyglot city, made illegal under the Mixed Marriages Act of the apartheid government. Alongside of this was the Group Areas Act, which had divided the city into black, white, and colored areas, the latter being the aforementioned mixed race group, who I should say make up a majority of people in the Western Cape. These segregationist policies divided all manner of amenities, such as schools, parks, toilets, and even beaches, to be used by people of a single race, which the best recorded for whites. My one time home on Derry Road, so evocative of the troubles of our own island, lay in the shadow of the triangular peak of the left of Table Mountain, perhaps ironically named Devil's Peak. They say that most towns are divided by two churches, a railway line, and a lot of opinions. This short road, no more than 100 meters in length, was sandwiched between the railway line and the Liesbeek River on land that had once been zoned off for the first Dutch farmers in Cape Town. It should be noted that they were not happy with this swampy land that was prone to flooding, And a nearby road was named Rokoop, whose translation meant raw buy or a raw deal. History does not record the feelings of the native people who it had been appropriated from. It is clear from the name of the suburb, Rondebosch, from the Dutch word Rondeboschen, after a local cattle stockade, that it belonged to the local Khoisan people. The land is now called Rondebosch Common and was later used as a concentration camp in the Boer War, where the British had a scorched earth policies and forced all the Afrikaner women and children into concentration camps. There is a memorial to the Irish soldiers who fought in that war just down the way on Stephen's Green. You'll see the names of battlefields like Colenso, Spionkop, Tugela Heights. My own great-grandfather, an Irishman, was in the Siege of Kimberley during that war. And this conflict was a war between apparently Christian peoples who could do the most ghastly things to one another in their fight over land that had never really belonged to them. Despite this obvious injustice and division from the outset, Cape Town was a mixed city with predominantly white male settlers having relations with native women, as well as slaves from elsewhere in Africa and from the Indonesian archipelago. Calvinist Christianity might have been the official religion under the Dutch rule, but there were also Muslim slaves from what is now Malaysia and Indonesia. And you can see many graves and cremats, which belong to many important personages who were exiled to Robben Island, even like in the 17th and 18th century. And these slaves would have worked on the company gardens, which was where they grew vegetables for the ships who were sailing. The company gardens in the city center are an icon of European aesthetics, filled with statues of powerful men overlooking bypasses surrounded by European-style buildings. These include the Houses of Parliament, where Cecil John Rhodes argued his imperialist cause in the Cape Colonial Parliament, and it was later shared with the Parliament of Pretoria and the Union of South Africa. The Natural History Museum on the southern end established its own notoriety when it shared images of native peoples alongside models of dinosaurs and more recent megafauna. It is easy to forget that for many years, cultural Christianity underpinned segregation where non-white peoples could be less than fully human, with racist bigots claiming that the story in Genesis about Ham, the son of Noah, gives a moral underpinning for this issue. Ham, of course, had seen his father lying drunk and had been cursed and sent away into exile in Africa, where his descendants turned black. And I quote, "And he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall be unto his brethren." Such is the moral underpinning for the racial discrimination and exploitation of our cultural Christianity. The company gardens and their environs provide just such a window into the colonial and cultural Christianity, for at the northern end stand St. George's Cathedral and the Slavery Museum. St. George's Cathedral is, of course, the Anglican Cathedral of Cape Town, while the Slavery Museum was once where the company slaves were kept. These unfortunate souls came from the Portuguese colony of Angola and Mozambique, as well as the Dutch colonies of Malacca and Java, to work in many of these buildings and, of course, the company gardens themselves. The gardens were, of course, built to provide fresh fruit and vegetables for the scurvy-ridden sailors of the Dutch East India Company, many of whom died of this disease after the lack of vitamin C took its toll over long voyages to the Indies. The ravages of this disease would rot the teeth of sufferers and eventually kill them, and their salvation was the fresh fruit and vegetables from the victualling station that became Cape Town. And it seems my past stretches up the Liesbeek River and into the narrow valley where the Kirstenbosch Gardens lie in a nestle in a rolling green valley. I did not always live on Derry Road, as my early childhood years were spent at an address at Bishop's Court, which owes its name to the residence of the Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town. The occupant at that time was Desmond Tutu, a famous opponent of apartheid who lived there despite the area having been designated a whites-only area under the Group Areas Act. While cultural Christianity had long been a shorthand for a concept of white us and non-white other, Archbishop Desmond Tutu was a living contradiction of this construct who lived in our midst. I am reminded of the works of Alan Paton, whose cry, "The Beloved Country," touched upon the fears of the racial divide in our country. No one wishes to make light of the fears that beset us, but whether we be fearful or no, we shall never, because we are a Christian people, be able to evade the moral issue. Desmond Tutu was not the only black resident of this area, since most of the mansions in the area had domestic workers who lived in tiny servant quarters on the premises, while their children and parents lived far away in their homelands and townships. The area had begun to look like a commuter suburb in the home counties, or perhaps for those of us in Dublin, like the green leafy suburbs that we know and love so well. Oak trees towered over rolling lawns and rose bushes, and a small stone church stood next to some stone cottages which looked for all intents and purposes like it was in the midst of a cricket green. A British-style pub called the Forester's Arms provided a further comparison to the feel of an English village, and in keeping with the tied pub system, it was owned and supplied by the local South African breweries. Paintings of medieval figures and carved heraldry lined the walls in this modern-day imitation of an English pub, and it seemed to all eyes like a corner of a foreign field that was forever England. The clientele were of mostly British extraction, and indeed one of the local expats included a Second World War veteran who would wax nostalgic about home. Home was England, a place that existed more in nostalgic memory than modern-day reality for this elderly general who sat at the bar in his short pants and long socks with his pipe and monocle. He had spent his war fighting the Japanese in Malaya, and with the empire gone, was wondering what it was all for. Of course, this was the 1980s, and the last outpost of white supremacy in South Africa was also on its last legs. And our cultural Christianity of white imperialism was ironically being challenged by the incumbent Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who was my near neighbor in Bishop's Court. Most people remember Bishop Tutu as the leader of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which offered amnesty to those who had committed atrocity under the apartheid regime in exchange for a full confession before the commission. Amnesty was offered in exchange for such ghastly deeds as had been committed, and it seemed like white South Africa could cling to the hypocrisy of its cultural Christianity due in no small part to the practice of actual Christianity in the form of forgiveness by our black compatriots. I think often of those far-off days, seemingly a Garden of Eden for a small boy to play in, catching tadpoles and trout in the river under the soaring oak trees. It was so easy to forget that this was an artificial environment created by white settlers to remind them of a far-off European home. My experiences of real Africa were hidden and yet all around. Reminders of a far-off of an immensely different past, present, and future somehow still stick in my memories of those days. One such trip was to the vast open sandy desert of Namibia to visit the National Park of Etosha Pan. After the First World War, South Africa took over this immense and thinly populated area after the German colonists had been driven out in the First World War. At the time, South Africa was fighting an insurgency against the Southwest African People's Organization, and I remember seeing groups of white conscripted South African soldiers standing at the side of dirt roads in the desert. They were hitchhiking home on leave on these hot and dusty roads, isolated and far from home in a moral and political wasteland. This may be an apt metaphor for the greater political situation our country found itself in, perhaps speaking of the Israelites in the desert after the flight from Egypt. Another memory was the coming of Halley's Comet, a sort of celestial event which might mean many kinds of portent for the future. I would lie on our garden lawn at night and watch this comet, and my father took us on the distant mountains to see it from the observatory there. I forget if the view in the Cedarburg really was so different from the lawn at home, but I do remember seeing the Bushman rock art in the cliff walls of those mountains. These small groups of hunter-gatherers lived there since time immemorial. Indeed, excavations from the Sterkfontein caves by Professors Broom and Dart suggest the evolution of mankind occurred right here in Africa itself. These phenomenal artists of these stunning paintings celebrating the sacred eland and praying mantis in their shamanic practices were driven into the deserts and inhospitable mountains by white settlers to escape extermination and enslavement. The language of these fascinating peoples were only translated in the mid-19th century by a German philologist, Wilhelm Bleek. Yet another memory was a visit many years after visiting, after moving from that house to the graveyard, behind a small stone church near Kirstenbosch Gardens. The gravestones were weathered with age, but some clearly legible inscriptions recorded the 19th century burials of so-called Cape Coloured people. They had been moved out under the Group Areas Act in the 50s, despite their ancestors having lived in South Africa since time immemorial. The parish records only record their baptism and death after their conversion to Christianity. I wonder at the suffering caused by this cultural Christianity, which served so neatly as a fig leaf for racial division. Despite the best efforts of a man like Desmond Tutu to heal such divisions in its name. The statement which was made after the fall of apartheid is that it should never happen again. However, with forgiveness, we hope to have put many such atrocities behind us. The Holocaust, the Crusades, and the slave trade, as well as apartheid, are now consigned to history, and many people find it all too convenient to forget what they or their ancestors have done within this ghastly context. Stories like those etched into the gravestones near my former home or onto the Cedarburg's cave walls are often out of sight and out of mind. A chronicler who recites events without distinguishing between major and minor acts in accordance with the following truth: nothing has ever happened which should be regarded as lost for history. To be sure, only a redeemed mankind received the fullness of its past, which is to say, only for a redeemed mankind has its past become citable in all its moments. Each moment it has lived becomes a citation à l'ordre du jour, and that day is Judgment Day. And that's a quote by Walter Benjamin.